Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Wild Hunt, the No Ship Network podcast on the History Channel series Vikings. I am your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em. And tonight we are discussing Vikings Season 5B, Episode 2, or also known as Episode 512. The episode is titled Murder Most Foul, and it was written by Michael Hurst and directed by Kieran Donnelly. Before we get into the episode coverage, we want to talk about the feedback deadline. Due to our erratic work schedules on the weekends, it's hard for us to really plan when we're going to record. So either we're recording on Friday nights or Saturday mornings, depending. Because of that, we've decided that the feedback deadline must be by Friday evenings, specifically 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, just to make sure that we get it in case we're recording on Friday nights. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we get to our feedback section. But if you have any questions, please feel free to shoot us an email at noshipnetwork@gmail.com. And that is also where you would submit your feedback if you wanted to discuss the episode with us.
All right. So you want to just jump right into it?
Yes. This episode opens right where we left off. The last time we saw Lagertha and company, they're being exited from what you described as the Viking clown car.
Cage.
Yeah.
I refer to it that way because I feel like at the end of last episode, there was only like three people who came out of it, three or four people. And then you see at least another two this time. It's almost like they said, well, wait a minute. They were all taken in this. So we have to have them all come out.
I was grateful for no one's trying to stone or throw vegetables or spit on Lagertha because I was waiting for it.
Yeah. They showed a little bit of mercy on us, the audience, by getting there right in front of Alfred for an audience pretty quickly.
In the next scene, Alfred and Æthelred discuss Hegman's long absence from home. Alfred wonders if Hegman has changed, and I think he's thinking about his own true father, Athelstan, and what he has learned possibly from Judith about Athelstan's experiences and changes that he himself went through after being exposed to Ragnar and his fellow countrymen.
Yeah, and you can imagine he's thinking, like, if my dad, the way he was changed by these guys, then this guy is definitely going to be prone to that.
Hegman then enters the room and he greets Judith, which seemed to have some sort of significance there. I know last season we were worried that there was going to be something happening between the two of them. We were dreading it. And thankfully, that wasn't the case. But they could still be toying around with the idea, and it felt like they were for that moment to me.
It's like they almost don't want it to completely leave your consciousness, you know? Like, okay, yeah, we probably think that he's dedicated to Lagertha at this point, but maybe, just maybe. Or we could look at it and pass it off as him just being chivalrous. I don't know if you're supposed to. Like, you'd think the king would get the preferential treatment in a situation like this. You bow to your new king first, then you recognize the other people. But maybe because she's the king's mother, I don't know. I don't know what the protocol is for that.
Yeah, it just seems like they made a point to show that interaction between them. And
yeah, they did. I'm trying to kind of come up with reasons for it, and that's the only thing I can think of besides the original one, like you said, which is probably the most realistic, like just that little drop.
And maybe it's supposed to remind us of his weakness with women.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just that.
As if we could forget.
Hegman is there to explain his absence. He's reporting to them about what he saw over in Scandinavia, specifically the recent battle where Ivar was victorious, and now he has brought Lagertha and company with him. And he's questioned by Alfred as to why he would do this, and he says to Alfred that he offered them safe passage. And Alfred's response really got me thinking about the weight of one's word, and because it seemed like he was just like, why? How could you do this to me? How could you give them your word like that? That now I must honor it too. And you and I had a little discussion about it, like that maybe it's not so much that as if it's more about the office that Hegman holds. And even though he's technically not in that position anymore, he's still operating under that sort of authority.
That's what struck me. That's kind of why I thought like he would be able to put the king in that kind of position, because being a bishop, you can kind of, you know, draw on some goodwill from your monarch and be like, hey, I told these people that you're going to give them your protection. So, you know, you got to pony up here.
Yeah, it just got me thinking about the weight of one's word. And is it true that people used to put more stock in stuff like that back then? And I mean, even a lot of our fantasy literature that is loosely based on our real history at that time puts a lot on oaths. between people. It's sad to think how so much has changed to where people can just say whatever and get away with it without any consequences.
No, I think you're right. I think in times past, people's word carried a lot more weight than it doesn't. You know, your point about a lot of the fantasy literature that we read, I'm thinking like Robert Jordan, Tolkien, stuff like that.
Even George R. R. Martin.
Yeah, even Martin. Yeah, true. But I don't even know if you'd have to go that far back. I mean, just a couple of generations ago, or, you know, even when we were kids, even it just seems to be, I don't know if it's just because I'm past the probable halfway point in my life, so I'm to start thinking of stuff like this, but it just seems like the deterioration of that just gets more and more rapid. Because, you know, I remember when kids, it was like, hey, you said you were going to do this. I mean, whether it's a pinky swear or a promise, or, you know, kids doing a little blood pact, or, you know, which I think died out pretty quick after the early 80s. But parents wouldn't, you know, let that shit fly anymore. But no, you're right. It's previous generations did a lot of that stuff too, and it is sad. It is sad that we can't just give our word that we're going to do something and then have that be taken for what it's worth and believe people.
Maybe it has more to do with the intensity of the religion too. Like, they felt God's gaze more than we do.
I always imagine people back then, like, thinking about how I thought of God when I was a little kid. And I know that sounds condescending as fuck, but, like, you know, that this person is always watching everything that you do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if there really is a God, that may be the case. But what a boring thing to be doing. But I mean, it you know, that everything that they're doing is. But see, with Hegman, though, that doesn't really fly, because he knows that God's watching him fornicate with all of these women. He tries to do his penance for that and, you know, walk in the light of God, as they say, and stuff like that. But he keeps going back to it. So
the next scene, we have Lagertha, Ubba, Bjorn, Torvi, and the rest in a holding cell in a prison.
Yeah. That's what it felt like. It felt like a holding cell. It didn't feel like the dungeon, you know? It didn't feel like you're going to be chained up to the wall to die in a place like that. But I could be wrong. I mean, they did say it was where Ragnar was kept.
Ubba and Bjorn are openly convinced that Hegman has betrayed them. Lagertha does not believe that he has. Bjorn accuses her of being a fool for love, and Tori has a nice comeback.
Yeah, so that was a good one. I felt like they were being the guys here were being like downers about this. They were only looking at the bad side of it. I mean, you come over and all you have is this particular bishop's word that everything's going to be okay. His countrymen haven't seen him in months. All right. So it's going to take a little bit of doing. The wheels of this have to be greased. It's not going to be instantaneous. And so where else would they be kept? It's like, hey, just use our halls for feasting and debauchery while we decide what we're going to do with you over here. Everything's kosher. It's like, I don't know. That seems like what would happen. Put the boot on the other foot, right? I mean, what would the Vikings do? They're just going to let them hang out in camp while they decide, like, what are you doing with all these Englishmen over here?
Well, it's like they're angrily voicing their thoughts here because they had walked into this situation with doubts to begin with.
Yeah.
But, you know, if that's the case, especially Bjorn, because he was given another offer by Rollo, like, you really don't have any room to talk because you didn't come up with an alternative.
Exactly.
You denied another opportunity and went along with this.
Yeah, he's pretty much the reason why they didn't go and do that, because that was a lot better of a deal. Because I think Rollo would have protected them and kept them safe. He would have been able to march them right back through Kattegat and then just flip the Viking equivalent of the bird to Ivar and Harald and say, I'm taking them back to Francia with me, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it because I have my whole fucking army right here. So, see ya. And then they're good. Now that they're walking into, you know, the mouth of the dragon over here, they don't know what's going to happen. So, yeah, like, they only have themselves to recriminate. You know, and I think Bjorn's being a little bit petulant by lashing out at Lagertha about that.
Yeah, and speaking of that, I'm wondering if that's also coming from another place, because we just come off the episode where Rollo comes and talks about him being his son. And if he's, you know, lashing out at his mom about that specifically here.
Fool for love.
Yeah.
So, there's some double meaning to that, or possibly more.
At dinner, Alfred proposes a toast in the honor of Hegman, describing him as a scourge of Vikings and a man of God. I think with that statement from Alfred and with Heckman's reaction as far as like the intensity he displayed when he drank the toast, is meant to play on our thoughts about Heckman's loyalties.
It's a psych out. The whole scene is a psych out, because you got exactly what you're talking about, the loyalties thing. And then when they say in that toast is Scourge of the Vikings. So they're making the audience go, oh, okay, you know, Ube and Bjorn's concerns are entirely valid, and that's exactly what's going to happen. You know in the back of your head that they're not going to get slaughtered outright. I mean, the show would be over. But it's just like, oh, shit, here we are. And then we switch over to Iceland right after that, so there's no follow-up. So it's just a little bait for the audience to be like, ooh, oh, no, what's going to happen? But
so, yeah, you mentioned Floki. We're going to cover everything that we saw with Floki in this episode right now to get it over with, because I am not fond of it.
You know, I do not think we are in the minority of not being too fond of this.
I don't think so either.
We watched this episode for the first time with your dad, and he wasn't real happy about it. He was just like, I'm not interested in this stuff so much.
Yeah.
And I haven't read any of feedback for this week's episode, but I'm guessing that most people are probably along the same lines.
So we start off with Floki praying to his god about his wayward followers, and he begins to doubt his previous visions, wondering if maybe he was insane.
Yeah, he repeats the why don't you believe in me or whatever, and they're like, well, perhaps you never did. You know, you were never there. I was imagining the whole thing in the first place, which is kind of a predictable path for him to go down after all this stuff happens, because so far the settlement's been pretty much a failure.
What isn't predictable about it is where Michael Hirst is definitively going to land on that, or even if he will definitively land on the answer to that question.
Yeah. Yeah, that's up in the air. I have no idea.
I personally hope he lands on insanity.
To see, like, Floki go insane? Like, truly insane?
Not that to go insane, that he has been insane.
Oh, I see. Okay, so this, it would just play out in the end that he's been hearing these voices and fooling himself, and he just has this... what do you call it? Delusions of grandeur and whatnot.
Not that it would necessarily be more interesting, because honestly, I would prefer a world where gods did exist, especially multiple gods that had all these different superpowers and whatever. That would be a much better world, in my opinion. But as far as like the character Eivind and how he actually fits in and creating a more complexity behind his intentions, behind everybody who followed Floki to Iceland, I would like to see him actually turn out to be a good guy, that his concerns are valid. I mean, what we see here, he is still complaining, which is annoying. I mean, I'm really kind of tired of hearing him complain, but they do look miserable. They're growing these vegetables that look as palatable as rope. I mean, I don't know what it is that they're pulling out of the ground. Frodi rides up and accuses Eivind of killing his brother. And Eivind's son is there, and he denies it. And Eivind doesn't necessarily deny it or admit to it, but the way he approaches it, I don't think he's guilty of it.
I do know that Eivind cannot be seen as completely clean of any guilt. Mm-hmm. Either he knows something, or he did something, or he was part of it, aiding and abetting the whole nine yards. But I do agree with you that, or I don't know if I necessarily agree with you because it hasn't happened yet, but I do agree with your sentiment about wanting to see Eivind be a more multidimensional character, to add a little bit of texture to that. Because when you divide the group up like that and you just have everybody who goes with Floki is correct, everybody who goes with Eivind is wrong, and it's just kind of like banal and boring. And I think it's part of the reason why people aren't really into these scenes, aside from the fact that people want Floki to be back to his old self, you know, the trickster, like his almost namesake,
yeah,
you know, Loki. But it's it would be nice to see that character develop and to see a side of him that's a little bit more. The one thing thing about this episode that's on this same like thread of thinking is that starting with Eivind, we get to see characters that we generally don't care for too much show a side of themselves, or begin to show a side of themselves that humanizes them and makes you almost feel, you know, bad for them. Not quite get behind them yet. It happens with him, it happens with Ivar, and it happens with Margrethe at the end. And so, you know, just because when he tells Frodi, he says, you know, your brother was a good boy, my son was a good boy, you're a good boy, but if you keep running your mouth, we're going to have problems.
Frodi accuses him of not caring for the community, where Eivind states that he does indeed care for this community. And I feel like that's where they're starting to build a little bit more about Eivind that we could possibly get behind.
Agreed. Yeah, that's the little catch right there. So the last scene that we have with Floki in Iceland is... it's kind of a repeat of the first scene that we had Floki by the waterfall. You just now add in Eivind,
yeah,
right? And he does it a little bit more emphatically, and he expresses his doubts. And she doesn't have a whole lot to say about it. She's just being a friendly shoulder for him to kind of cry on. but he feels like he just led everybody over here for something that was maybe in his head. And so that's got to weigh on you if that's what you're thinking. But I don't know where Hurst is going with this, but I will say that I'm hoping for two things. One, obviously, that the whole Iceland thing gets a lot more interesting real quick. And two, that part and parcel with that is Eivind's character becoming more complex, like mm-hmm. we talked about.
All right, that's it for the Floki storyline. Lagertha and company are brought before Alfred now. Alfred proposes bringing them on as mercenaries, essentially. Bjorn wants the land that he is sure that he is entitled to. Lagertha interrupts and says that they accept the offer. And this is when Alfred says that this was Hegman's idea. You see Lagertha look at Hegman approvingly.
Yeah, yeah. She's got confirmation that he's not betraying her.
Yeah, so far.
Yeah, so far. At least so far as we could see.
Alfred gives the Vikings reign of the royal villa. He says he knows that his grandfather, which would be Ecbert, would approve of their status and their relationship right now between Alfred and the Vikings due to Ecbert's love of Ragnar. After Lagertha and company departs, Alfred asks Hegman if he can trust them. He says, "You can trust Lagertha."
So I like Lagertha in this scene, because when Bjorn pipes up and says, "We have a legal right to that land that in, you know, East Anglia that Ecbert told us we could have," and Alfred's like, "Look, you're going to get that, but you need to prove to me first that you're worthy of it by fighting for me in battle." And he's like, "No, it's ours by right, blah, 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 blah." And then that's when Lagertha steps in and she's just like, We agree to the terms. Because she's already got it figured out. She's like thinking like a chess player, and she's two steps ahead of Bjorn, and she's got the cooler head in this instance. And she just goes, "Look, no matter what, we're going to have to jump through this hoop for these people to prove that we're not just, you know, wolves in the hen house or foxes in the hen house, whatever the thing is. And that's not going to not happen. So let's just do this.
We're clearly at their mercy."
Yeah. Yeah. They're calling the shots here. So play along and make nice. Everything will go a lot easier. You know, like, I think whenever Bjorn swims for fun, he only swims upstream.
Now we're to the part where Hegman is requesting his bishopric, or the office of bishop. He laughs when he learns that Lord Cuthred has replaced him. I'm wondering if there's like any history between him and Æthelred here, because they get in each other's faces really quick.
Yeah, and I almost feel like he's using Æthelred as a surrogate, because he's pissed off about the situation, Hegman is, and he gets in his face and he says, "And how did you come to this decision?" And he's obviously talking about Alfred, because he's king. So, but he says it to Cuthred's face, because I think he can't get in Alfred's face, but he's that level of pissed off.
So Æthelred is the whipping boy.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and that's definitely a possibility, and that sucks for Æthelred, and that's really going to piss him off down the road if that continues to happen.
Yes.
Or it could also be that there's some history, and he just knows Æthelred was involved in the advising of doing that.
If that's the case, I want that information, because that would be a really fun little flashback for them to do, and, you know, have that, like, show the scene why there's a bone of contention between these two.
Alfred admits that he isn't happy with Cuthred in that position, but he isn't strong enough to remove him on his own, especially in Heckman's favor. And Hegman wants to know why, especially. And Alfred starts to talk about how he was over in Scandinavia, not in the name of their lord, but fighting the name of the pagan gods. And so Hegman comes back declaring himself as Christ's warrior on earth. Alfred believes him, but Hegman must prove himself to the others who have doubt.
It's an interesting power dynamic, because he's on his side, ostensibly. He's like, "Look, man, I believe you, but, you know, like, let's kill a couple of birds with a single stone, you know what I mean? Help me help you get this situation rolling, because if he can gain more power by having this whole Vikings thing prove out, and then he can give the person who brought him this power his position back." But
I like Alfred's leadership style so far. I like how he's forthright. You know, he's speaking clearly about what his positions are,
yeah,
what his strengths are, what he can do about the situation, what he would like to do about the situation in the future. He's also putting his trust openly in people, saying, "I believe you," and whatever. And then you and I had a discussion when we were watching it, because at the point where Hegman tells Alfred, "Trust Lagertha," and I was like, "Well, that's kind of weird, because I know because I've already seen this episode, we're not going to see him talk to Lagertha at all. He's going to have meetings with Bjorn and Uba alone later. And you made a really great point that he's working on building the trust with them since he's already got the trust with Lagertha.
Yeah, it's wasted effort to keep going after her. So he just work on the people who you need to get on your side, you know. And it's a great strategy, and it falls in line with the straightforwardness that you were saying. In my mind, I'm trying to compare him to Ekbert, whom he learned everything from. And Ekbert is just, it makes you wonder if Ekbert started off like this as a leader when he was younger, and then experience and getting stabbed in the back and age and wisdom and just brought him to this kind of cynical thing where he was just ready to do everything he did to do what he did, you know, stab Ella in the back, Ayla, King Ayla in the back, and take his portion of England and do what he did with the little land transfer dance. You know what I mean? Go like, okay, I'm going to abdicate the throne to Aethelwulf. Then I'm going to sign this, making everybody think it's legit. But really, this guy's got the power. So na-na-na-na-na-na.
Well, thankfully, Athelstan's nature that has been passed on to Alfred will smooth the edges of Ekbert's nurture.
Do you think it was possible, Ekbert being as cunning and as smart as he was and forward-thinking, did this for multiple reasons? When he abdicated the throne for Aethelwulf, do you think he saw far enough into the future that this was a situation that he would want to put in Alfred's hands, because now he has that as a tool? Because if they had this paperwork that's showing them that Ekbert gave him the lands, mm-hmm. it's indisputable. Mm-hmm. But he knows the truth of it, and he says, well, actually, he wasn't allowed to do that for all the reasons we've already talked about. But now he has the power to give them the lands, but he can extract something out of them first. So it gave him a leg up in any future, you know, doings with the Vikings.
He would have to have been banking on Aethelwulf's premature death by a bee sting or whatever.
That's true. But he could have been giving that power to Aethelwulf as well, mm-hmm. in doing the same thing. But I think he had a lot more faith in what Alfred would do than what Aethelwulf. Because anyway, just something that had occurred to me.
I mean, he was definitely kicking the can down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it seemed like something that was done out of expediency at the time that they did it in the show. But now that there's like another couple of layers to it, I'm just wondering how far ahead we're supposed to think that Ekbert was thinking, you know. But I don't know if that's just me putting something on it.
So our next scene is with Ivar, and he's announcing his intent to marry Freydis to his people. Everyone cheers with the exception of Harald and possibly also Fitzurk and Margaret, but they're not in camera. Harold's concerned about him producing an heir, and Margaret reveals that Ivar can't produce children because he is boneless. Later on, Harold congratulates Ivar and Freydis. Fitzurk is drunk and accuses Ivar of insulting the gods.
If we had a Metal Might quote of the week for Vikings, it would be this one with Ivar going, I think it's your bedtime, Fitzurk. I don't know why. It's just a funny little jab, because he wakes him up and he's just like, blah, blah, blah. And this scene is kind of weird in relation to what happens later on when, towards the very end with Margrethe and the three guys that come in. And we'll talk about it more then, but it's just odd to me. They don't line up.
So now that Ivar and Freydis are alone, Freydis comes on to him, and then we switch to where they're in the bedroom, and she swears by his blood that she will have a son, one that will always be at his side no matter what. And the promise of a son is attractive enough, but then also to have the promise of someone who is going to be completely loyal to you no matter how crazy you are.
She even says peace, war, and treachery. Mm-hmm. So she's laying out all the circumstances that this person's going to be loyal to you, and then
you'll be unlike your brothers.
Right. This person will be bound to you in the same. It's almost like she knows the relationship that he had with his mother, and then started to have with his father whenever, you know, Ragnar took him to England with him on that last jaunt that Ragnar had. So she's kind of playing off of that completeness that's really, you know, all Ivar ever wanted out of life, you know, before he decided to conquer everything. But he just wanted to be accepted and wanted to know that people had his back. And he's not a sympathetic character to me, but this is the weak spot that I have for him, because it's just like he just wants people to be on his side and with him. So she's mm-hmm. she knows that she's got this insight somehow. And I don't know about you, but the whole thing, like when she was cutting his hand and licking the blood and doing all of this other stuff. Like, I thought maybe there was some sort of, we were supposed to perceive it as some sort of magic that was being worked and he was actually going to be able to perform and have a child. But it turns out that's not the case. But she's pretty good at being manipulative. At least, you know, she's
got his number.
Yeah, for sure.
Playing him like a fiddle. So next we have Heckman confronting Lord Cuthred. At first, when Heckman walks in, Lord Cuthred says, "Let us embrace and thank God for your return." When he says that at first watch, you know, I'm thinking, oh, he's such a liar, you know, and men of God shouldn't lie outright in church and all like that. But then, you know, some of the things he says later about the reasons why he writes Heckman a letter has me doubting my initial thoughts about that. And maybe he does have true concerns about Heckman's status or relationship with their lord.
It's possible, but I still view it cynically, because when he, whatever he puts forth in that vein, in this instance, he's saying it to Heckman because he wants to put that out there.
Yeah.
Later on, when he has his henchmen and he's writing the note, he's saying it for that guy's benefit. You know, to say, well, because of the love I bear Hammond and stuff like that, I'm going to do this. Now, I don't think he actually cares. I think he's a social climber, and he is he's not a man of God. It's debatable whether Heckman is either, but I feel like this is somebody who saw a vacated spot and said, this is part of my way to the top.
Yeah, because this is something you and I had a little mini discussion about when we were watching it, because Heckman claims that he has more loyalty to their God and that their God knows his struggles, and at least his struggles are spiritual. And I was like, wait a minute, are Cuthred's not, his struggles not spiritual? What would you describe them as? Is more worldly? And what makes Heckman's struggles specifically spiritual?
I've got no answer for that, because so far I don't know what Cuthred's struggles are, but I know that
it's with power.
Yeah, okay, so he's a, like we said, he's a social climber. He wants power. He's power hungry, so he'll do whatever he wants.
And the reason why
I
think that is because Heckman actually emphasizes power as Cuthred's main attraction to the bishopric office.
Right, okay. That makes sense. Okay, so he's power hungry, and that's his problem. That's his cross to bear, pun intended. But here you have Heckman saying that his struggle is spiritual, and just like, you know, Jesus fought the devil in the desert, he has to deal with his own demons and stuff like that too. But carnality in that sense, it seems like a very physical thing. It doesn't seem like it's a, I guess it feels spiritual because you're trying to fight your way back to some sense of holiness after you have these lapses.
I mean, are there certain sins that can be classified that way? Like if you struggle with lust, that is something like a temptation that comes from a spiritual war, where if you're power hungry, that's more of a worldly thing, like an earthly man-made temptation. I don't know.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. I do know that people, you're probably right, because people tend to romanticize problems that they have, you know, mm-hmm. they romance, and then other people do the same thing for them. So when somebody's dealing with a thing in their life, they frame that in a way that says, okay, well, you're not just being some jerk who is sleeping with everything that gives him a chance to. You're having a spiritual struggle. There's an issue here. So it just really depends on how people want to frame things. But I can see how one would be looked at that way, his struggle, Heckman's struggle, and then the other one just being this like bare power grab, you know, with nothing to really disguise it as being anything else.
It's like claiming to be a sex addict.
Sure,
just giving yourself a reason.
Yeah, exactly. You definitely have a problem, and if it helps you to give it a name like that, give it a name so you can fight it or whatever. But a lot of times it just seems like an excuse to go, hey, I'm not a jerk who's fucking too many people. I'm a victim. I'm a victim here. So I don't know. But on my second viewing of this scene, I kind of saw it as a scene with two villains in it, because I feel like the compare and contrast between their two quote-unquote struggles was kind of bullshit. It's almost like, you know, Heckman has the upper hand and the edge here as far as reality is concerned, is because he was the one who held this bishopric before, and the only reason that anybody else has it is because they thought he was dead. But, you know, they go back and forth, and at the end of it, the dummy that he is, Cuthred lets it be known that he is trying to, you know, he's trying to defend the fact that he is doing what he's doing and saying, look, I'm trying to save the church from Alfred because he's attacking it. He's doing these things when all he wants is to make it accessible to everybody, you know, and not be in Latin, so on and so forth. And that is just that little bit that Heckman needed. And there you go.
Which, you know, especially from our modern perspective, looking back at Alfred's desire for that change in the church, it does not seem like an attack. It's just a change that should be positive. But with people who like Cuthred, they're threatened by it because it removes power from them.
Sure. Yeah. Because if you're the arbiter, if you're the filter through which everybody gets the word of God, then you can kind of fudge it around the edges, especially if nobody else knows Latin. So.
Yeah, you seem to be less valued.
Yeah.
Your value goes down as a result.
It would be like four people being the only people who have the access to the internet. And then, you know, perceiving everybody as wanting access to the internet in their homes as a threat to their power. You know, it's not an attack. It's just share the information, guys.
But Cuthred did not actually say that he was going to overthrow or attempt to rile up others to overthrow Alfred.
No, he did not. You are correct about that. He did not. And this is why, another reason why I feel like he took a seed of something and decided to grow it. Him being Heckman, he took a seed of something and decided to grow it into the giant beanstalk because it serves his purpose.
Yeah, he was just collecting excuses this whole episode to kill Cuthred.
That's a good way to put it. He's got a little notepad. Yep, there's another check mark right there. He's a jerk. He's an a-hole. And he's going to try to overthrow Alfred. The next scene is with Freydis and Ivar's servant. And this episode moves fast in a lot of ways, and here's a great example of it. I didn't think that this thing happening, which turns out to be a necessity, would have happened for a little while. I thought it was going to take its time to unfold, but here it is, and I guess there's an unspoken code with Vikings. They can just walk up to each other and just the bedroom eyes, like, hey, you know. There was no talk. There was no, like, hey, I need you to do me a favor. Can you come with me? It's just like, apparently, back then, if a woman just stares at you long enough, you know you're getting it on.
I know, because my mind just started working during that scene, because there's no communication, at least no verbal communication between them. So I was like, wait, have they been like working together this whole time? And we're just now finding out that they've conspired to take down Ivar together?
That had not occurred to me. That I feel like I should have thought of that.
I don't think that's the case.
I don't think so either. I don't think that's the case either. But I feel like I should have, like, my mind should have kind of went in that direction. But once I saw them going into the little place, hopefully there wasn't a bunch of salted fish around. But
I was going to say fish shack.
Yeah, the fish shack. there's still a mess to clean up in there from years back. But I knew what was happening and what was going to go on. And so it's pretty much a no-nonsense scene. He's a sperm donor. And she got what she needed. And apparently, we don't have another scene, so apparently it took the first time. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I guess they're both relatively young and
fertile,
so there you go.
So now we're back in the royal villa. Heckman speaks with Lagertha, and he tells her about how they want to kill him. Him being the king and they being Cuthred. I really took her response to that as if she was worried that somebody wanted to kill Bjorn, because her...
It makes sense the way that she reacted to what he said, that whoever the he is a little closer to her than that response would have indicated if you were to think that she knew he was talking about Alfred.
Well, yeah, I mean, because all the worries about them being in this potential danger zone is still going to be at the forefront of her mind. So when somebody's telling her they want to kill him, her mind's going to go straight to Bjorn. So that's how I took how her very intense response to what he was saying. But he specifies to her that it's Alfred that they want to kill.
Which isn't much better, really, if she steps back and thinks about it. Because if they do kill Alfred, you know, they haven't even fully gotten into his good graces. They still have some proving to do. So if another monarch was to take over, they're back at square one, and they could just be head on a pike time.
Why show us the scene? Is it to show us their camaraderie?
Yeah, it's to reinforce that it's not just a physical relationship.
Yeah.
I think to show that he views her as an equal, somebody he can confide in. his thoughts. And it's also a little bit of exposition for the audience, if we didn't get it from the scene in the church, that he is either deciding to believe or honestly believes, Hegman, that is, that Cuthred is part of a cabal of people who are going to try to take the king down.
And is it the only way Michael Hurst can think of to use Lagertha? Because, I mean, again, she's just kind of a side piece.
Yeah, she doesn't have a whole lot going on in this episode.
No.
You know, there really isn't a whole lot going on for her. And so, I mean, even Torvi only got, like, she got her little snap in when they were all in jail. But other than that, she just has a quick sparring scene with Uba. And, you know, hopefully there's more with her down the road. But I feel like sometimes when you get to this stage in a series, there's so many characters that there has to be downtime for them. And, you know, I'm almost wondering if he's like, they're going to start doing characters like focus episodes at some point just to, I mean, I don't know if they'll go that route, but that seemed like something they only really did with Ragnar.
Next, we have the introduction of Princess Elswith, who wants to be elsewhere with someone else, as we will find. She has been selected to marry Alfred by Judith, and she is a family relation also.
Judith's niece.
Mm-hmm. We have a scene with Alfred speaking with Bjorn and Uba. The land deed is brought forth, and Alfred explains that Egbert was no longer king when he signed it. Bjorn expresses in disdain, so it was all a lie, and Alfred doesn't respond verbally here, but his exasperation is evident, and he doesn't concur. I think he's actually conflicted because he doesn't want to maybe think of Egbert as a liar, and he's certainly not going to say that out loud about someone that he respected and loved.
Yeah.
And I think he's also just choosing to kind of like think about it a little bit more and maybe come to a conclusion later.
I feel like Alfred does a really good job of explaining himself in this scene, because he tells them, he's like, listen, you guys have getting more truth out of me than you have a right to expect. So you need to stop. You know, you're here at my largesse. So it's just like, just chill out and relax. You came to me. I'm doing what I can. And when I can make this work, I will. So just cool your jets, have something to eat, you know, practice your sword fighting. I'm going to go meet my new wife. and he takes his leave. But I was proud of him. Sounds weird, but I was kind of, I guess that fits, though. I was proud of the character, because I feel like he has that, the training that he's received, the wisdom that he's been a receptacle for is coming out in the best way possible here with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and then also just his natural response to these accusations, like Uba suggesting that he himself is lying, and he denies this vehemently, but it comes across like, I believe him when he says it, like,
yeah,
without a doubt.
Yeah. And it's like you were saying before, that he's so straightforward.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, when you look at the way that Bjorn looks at him as he says, drops all that information, then turns to leave, Bjorn doesn't even move. He just kind of looks, and he's thinking. And I think he has gained a measure of respect for him. And he said, okay.
Really?
Yeah, I think he feels like this guy is trying his best and his hands are tied, and he's being straight with me. You know, he's saying to me, hey, listen, I'm going to do this when I fucking can, but right now,
I'm going to go screw your soon-to-be wife.
Speaking of which, the next scene is the dinner where Elswith is kind of looking around and checking out everybody in the court, and she's got eyes for Bjorn for sure.
She's heard a lot about him.
Oh, yeah, she has. And she brings up a good point here about how he talks about, well, this is the first time that Alfred's really engaging her in any kind of conversation. And he says, oh, I knew your father, and, you know, he died at York defending us and everything. And she's just like, I don't really know anything about that. I just know that he died. And, you know, he died fighting the Northmen, and they're here. Why are they running around in your court? And he's like, well, actually, and he explains the whole situation in a truncated version. And that's when she's like, oh, yeah, I've heard about him. And a red flag right there. Should have just been like, oh, great. Yeah. But so the big thing in this scene to me, though, was Æthelred kind of leans in and he's like, listen, we've got some stuff to deal with. There's the Archbishop of Canterbury has summoned a holy synod to discuss Alfred's attacks on the church. And a holy synod is a gathering of bishops. Hmm. So in the more orthodox Christian religions, I guess they still do that or whatever. But so yeah, the there's powers that are feeling threatened by Alfred's, not even decisions, because they haven't let him decide this, just his desires to do certain things, to have things be made, because nobody gives up any kind of power willingly. So, and even that bit of power, like we talked about before, the whole language thing is important. And there's also, you know, people are upset with him keeping pagans in the villa, and these are not the only voices. So this is a really good scene, in my opinion, because it shows this need that Alfred has. It's the pressure that's on him, but this need to consolidate all of the power that he has. And so it makes it, I think we have a deleted scene somewhere in here, because I think there's a discussion that goes on between him and Hegman about this very subject. And that's why Hegman feels like he can kill Cuthred with impunity later
Maybe.
On. That it's a guess on my part, obviously, but my gut is telling me that, mostly because of this scene, mm-hmm. and that, you know, what Æthelred's telling him and that need to get his power base really solidified.
Well, it also sets up the next scene where we have Elswith watching Torvi and Ubbe spar. Her companion is appalled at the freedom that has been granted to the Vikings within the royal villa. He is especially appalled due to the history of these specific Vikings in relation to King Ella and King Egbert. And that's showing these are the others, as Æthelred has informed Alfred, that have issues with his dealings with the Vikings here.
Yeah, and you know, we're on the side of Alfred, obviously. You know, where our loyalties and sympathies as the audience lies is obvious. But really, if you take a step back and put yourself in his position, you would probably feel the same way about these Vikings. You would just be like, you know, you didn't just watch 5 seasons of Ragnar and company. You're an English person, you know, living. You're a Saxon, and these people have killed your family, your kinfolk, and you know. So I think it's an important thing to show that other side, to kind of give voice to, you know, it's not black, white, bad, good, you know, this kind of dichotomy. It's like people have real concern. So I'm interested to see how deftly Alfred handles them and kind of folds everything in, because I think he will do it deftly.
Is this where Bjorn starts glaring Elswith's pants off?
Yeah. I'm going to look at you so hard, your pants are going to come off.
Next, we have Hegman and Lagertha having a romantic ride into the woods, but they are not alone.
Nope, we got a creepy spy following them around.
So next, we have Ubbe meeting with Alfred, and Bjorn is not with them this time. Alfred gets to the main point of why he's got Ubbe there, which is to suggest that Ubbe renounce his gods and publicly be baptized. He's asking this specifically from Ubbe alone. Ubbe actually sits down to think about this. In fact, this is the point where he takes the wine that was offered to him earlier in the scene that he shunned. I know historically Ubbe does eventually become baptized, but I'm not sure at what point in the relationship that happens. But
and this won't be the first time that a Viking has willingly let himself be baptized for the greater good, kind of taking one for
no.
the team.
And it did not go over well when Rollo did that.
No, that was a big, big fork in the road for Floki and Rollo's relationship.
Yes. As well as Rollo's relationship with everybody else. I mean, I think it was just another thing for everybody to remember that Rollo did that was treacherous.
Right, right. I mean, even DJ Torstein wasn't happy with it, you know, like nobody was. This isn't the first time something like this has happened, but when I watch this scene, it makes me, the thing that I think about the most isn't the baptizing of a Viking necessarily, it's why did Alfred choose him? And what I'm thinking, him being Ubbe, and what I'm thinking is, out of the three people who could be considered the leaders of the Vikings at this point, I think he's already been told he can trust Lagertha, so we don't have to worry about pursuing her. And Bjorn is never going to go for this idea, so he picks the one who is going to be amenable to it. He picks the one who he figures that he can talk to the most and be reasonable with. And he gives him a little bit of flattering, saying, you know, your disposition is the most like your father's out of anybody here, so I'm going to talk to you about this.
Did he say disposition, or did he say closest to your father? Did he mean disposition, or did he mean like as in relationship?
I took it to mean disposition-wise. I took it to mean he's closest to his father in the sense of how his father had, in his worldview, perhaps, at least in its nascent form, because I just don't think Ubbe is as experienced as all that.
But that's debatable. But I think it's closer to the truth than to say he's closer as far as like in relationally.
Yeah, I took it to mean the former, not the latter, because that's just how it struck me.
That makes more sense. Which, you know, I haven't seen a lot of examples of that, though. Or not anything that has really struck me.
I'm trying to think.
They really went out of their way to try to make him look most like Ragnar.
Yeah.
But Bjorn tries to behave like Ragnar.
But his is almost like a caricature. It's an affectation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas I think in Ube, you have the physicality of somewhat of a resemblance or a passable resemblance. And then you have, as far as disposition is concerned, he's not so quick to anger as some of the others.
True.
You know, as Bjorn, as Ivar. So, and I know we talked about it before that, like, I think it was definitely in a previous season, but how each of the brothers got a little bit of Ragnar in them as far as personality is concerned, like a certain facet of the personality. And I think Ube could be said to have his maybe a little bit of his contemplative side, at least in this instance. Or, you know, and it all could be nothing, and Alfred is just kind of going, you're my mark. I'm going to get you to agree to this.
Next scene we have Ivar's nightmare, where Freydis is telling Ivar that she is pregnant with his child. He tells her he loves her, and then she stabs him in the chest, and she turns into a laughing, cackling Margrethe. He wakes up and sees that Freydis is sleeping soundly by his side. As a result, Ivar brings his concern about Margrethe to Fitzurk. Fitzurk says, "Not to worry, she won't kill you, Ivar." Ivar turns to Harald and wants to know why he is still there. He says, "Are you staying here so you can kill me and then take over Kattegat?" And Harald's like, "I don't want to deal with that mess." And he says he's planning on raiding England here soon. So this is where Ivar says that Freydis is with child. Harald gives him a congratulations, but also says that business doesn't always work out so well, just so you know.
Yeah, if you're a jackass and you pretty much kidnap your wife, it probably doesn't work out so well. I mean, I don't just throwing that out there. I mean, I don't know. What did you think of the fact that this is the first time that we've seen Ivar in this half of the season crawling, and he crawls to where Fitzurk and Harald are. He's approaching them he's approaching them to talk to them almost with weakness. You know, he just had this bad dream. He's paranoid about Margrethe. He's paranoid about Harald. He's throwing all of this stuff out there to try to, like, it's almost like he's trying to make things be the way they are by saying that they are that way rather than having it really be that way. Like, "Oh, look, my brand new wife is with child already. So why are you still here? You need to get out of here, and you need to go ahead and get rid of your girlfriend because she's going to try to kill me." And I don't know. It felt like he was trying to negotiate these things from a disadvantaged point. And they had a physical representation of it by him crawling into the room.
I don't know, or he's just not threatened by them at all, so he has no problem showing his weakness around them.
Well, that could be it too, yeah. I could buy that, but the reason why I don't completely is because I think he's not threatened by his brother, but I think he is threatened by Harald because he is sticking around, and when Harald says he's going to start raiding with England, I felt like it was a weak sauce excuse. Like, that's not really what he's going to do. I don't know what he's going to do, but I kind of felt like his mannerisms and the way that he said it just felt like it was off the cuff. Like, he goes, "Oh, yeah, I'm actually leaving because I'm going to go raiding because that's what I really want to be doing right now, not hanging out with you losers." But there's other plans swirling in his head.
It could also be taken as he's throwing some shade at Ivar, like, as far as, like, what he's doing as a leader now. Like, you're just hanging around here and kind of, like, wallowing in your own bull crap. I'm going to go and improve my economy by going to raid another country and steal their loot and whatever.
Get some plunder.
Yeah.
You know, like make things happen. Because even, like you pointed out already, that he said, "Oh, I don't want to rule Kattegat, this mess." I mean, he's basically just, he's calling what you've created and what you're ruling over a mess. And he doesn't even challenge him on that point. He just lets it go.
We have another scene where there's more spying happening on Lagertha and Hegmund, which actually caused me to recall the time way back when she would take her baths when she first took control of Hedeby.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the one guy was spying on her
that she
eventually had killed.
She should have a sixth sense for that now.
Yeah. Well, she should just assume that anytime she's, you know, doing the beast with two backs or taking a bath, that somebody's going to be watching. Just
my dad will be.
He will. And We watched this episode with Em's dad, and we were talking about some of the stuff that happened in the previews and whether or not it's really going to happen or not. And we were thinking about Lagertha getting killed fairly early on in the season. And he was like, oh, no, I was about to drive out there and save her. Big Lagertha fan.
So next we have Alfred apologizing to Elswith about not getting to know her better. He promises to make up for it.
Said, I got king shit to do, girl. Just relax. Have some ale.
Within minutes, though, Elswith is met face-to-face with Bjorn, and they meet up in the horse stables. Like, somehow they just communicated, hey, we're going to meet up over here. And they kiss. It's very bizarre. I hate it.
Speaking of deleted scenes, why didn't they just delete this one? Like, I would have much rather had a connective tissue scene with Alfred and Hegman talking about Cuthred. Like, this is just bullcrap. I don't need it. I feel like every season we're getting a new love interest for Bjorn, and they're all short-lived, and it's just weird. There's almost a little bit of humor to the whole thing as far as how fast it's happening, but I don't know if it's intentional or not.
It's not. There's just too much time, and they're whiling away the time with this weird soap opera stuff.
Well, that's the thing. It's you know, we always speculate about how when you stretch out and you do two parts of the season, then they're both 10 episodes long, so you got a 20-episode season, instead of just doing 13 or 14 really strong, solid episodes like it used to be, you do this. And we've talked about that ad nauseum, but it feels weird. Like, sometimes you get filler and you just have to deal with it. But it feels weird when parts of the story don't speed up, but other parts are going way too fast.
Yeah.
So that's where that like weird friction of it comes in. So I'm not against any particular storyline per se. Some I like better than others, obviously, but it's just that the moving at different paces is what throws you off.
Next scene, we have Cuthred learning about Hegman and Lagertha's relationship from his dispatched spy. He says, poor Hegman, he could never control his passions. And he decides to write him for the love he owes him. So you think he was doing that for the benefit of the spy?
Yeah, I believe so. Like, he was trying to stay in form of his bishop position.
Okay, I could buy that.
Yeah, that's how I took that.
I think I was hoping for more complexity from him as well as.
It's possible. I'm not saying that it's outside of the realm of possibility. Yeah. It's only my opinion anyway. But I'm not saying that he couldn't have been doing it. But the Cuthred is. Too close to cutthroat. You know, it's like he's doing whatever he needs to do to get in whatever position he really wants to be in. And he essentially signs his own death warrant here.
Speaking of somebody signing their own death warrant, Fitzurk finds Margaret on the floor next to their bed. She is upset about Freydis being pregnant. She's still upset about Uba and Torvi. She says Ivar is not kind, and she suggests to Fitzurk that he should kill Ivar, and he tells her to go to sleep. So I don't think it's just Ivar who has a hand in the next time we see her and what happens there.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
I really don't. I think that was his doing, Fitzurk's doing. And, you know, they throw around this idea that she's mad, and we talk about Floki possibly being mad, but I think Margreth really is mad. Margreth, she even calls herself that later, and she's obsessed. She's got this problem. She wants to be. She was elevated from a slave girl, and then she never showed appreciation to anybody who let her have a higher station in life, which they didn't need to do because this society does have slaves. And then she decided she wanted to be king queen. She wanted to be queen for whatever reason she thought she deserved that. And she wants to manipulate these brothers into killing each other, or at least killing Ivar. And I understand that stems from a fear of him early on, but at the same time, it's just like, when do you get over this and move on? You know, if you were to just have like been quiet, you could have probably just stayed with the last brother, you know, and instead of trying to manipulate him into doing something stupid. Now you're going to try with the next brother and try to manipulate him into doing something dumb. So,
yeah, I mean, there could be like a combination of the insecurity of, you know, suddenly being taken out of a position of slavery and getting a taste of freedom and not having a secure position to make sure that she was completely removed from going back to that. So maybe that was a big part of her drive. And then also having been a witness to some of the shenanigans and the scheming and whatever other words you can throw in there behind the scenes when she was a slave within Alslog's household.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. I mean, I can see that as a probable cause kind of thing. Like, that's what's driving her.
Yeah.
Is because she just doesn't, but she's aiming really high is all I'm getting at. You know, like she couldn't.
And that was her guidance in a way, too, is being around that.
Yeah. So people scheming for the top dog position, because it just seems like you would have been better off if you had said, okay, I'm not a slave anymore. Okay, good. To make sure, hey, there's John over there and he's the head of the stable guys. So I'm just going to marry him and go live a quiet life and nobody will notice me anymore. And you would have been all right. Now, you know.
Because on the face of it, what she was saying about what upset her are things that are upsetting.
Yeah, yeah. And that's part of what I was saying earlier about how this and the scene where she's got the knives in her, I started to feel that like pang of like, oh, okay, there's a little bit of sympathy that can be drummed up inside of me for this character. But, you know, kind of like Omar from The Wire says, if you come for the king, you better not miss. So she keeps trying to do this and it's not going to end well.
Yeah.
So the next scene is Elswith and Bjorn, and we all wish we were elsewhere.
Oh, I hated this scene so much.
You had brought up something to where, like, okay, what if we have like another situation, like a Athelstan situation going on?
Yeah.
To where
they're repeating something that they thought was a good thing, and they're just going to do a remix.
So we're getting as much Viking blood into the royal bloodline of the Saxons as possible is what we're trying to do here, or what Hurst is trying to do here.
I just want to say I hated the fact that she said, I'm a virgin. And there was like this pause for our benefit. I don't know.
Just let that sink into the reader's mind. At least you bring up the creepy factor. At least Bjorn didn't have a reaction to that. You know, at least he wasn't like, awesome, or by the gods, or something stupid like that. They just faded the scene out.
Next scene, Margaret is assassinated. I'm not sure if she really deserves assassination, if assassination is the right deserving word to describe this for her and someone in her position. But having multiple people show up in hoods throwing knives at you smacks of assassination to me. So that seems to be the best word for it.
You know, and I felt like they wanted to heighten the tension by having three guys come in there and do this, because we've never known her to be a fighter. So, I mean, one guy could have just come in. There's no dramatic element to it if one guy comes in and just puts a knife in her. But it probably would have been that simple if the guy knew what he was doing. But you have three guys coming in, so you're just like, oh no, what's going on? And this is also where I felt a little bit, you know, bad, because it's just like, wow, they're really.
It felt unreal, though, to me, too, because I kept expecting it to turn out to be a nightmare.
Yeah, because they had done it earlier. Like, you know, Ivar gets the knife in the chest, and it obviously turns out to be a dream. So why not this, too? But it's too late now. They can't make this be a dream at the beginning of next episode.
Yeah, because that might be the main impetus behind having multiple people show up in hoods, because we have never seen this before. It's not like Ivar has starter car forces that we know of, or some sort of like little specially trained,
yeah, like his death squad,
imperial soldiers, I don't know what you call them,
like Viking green berets.
Yeah
There's no, it doesn't seem to have like an equivalent to that, so I don't know. So the next scene, we have Hegman getting his letter from Cuthred with the threats to expose him and saying that you're never going to be prince of the church. Basically just letting him know that the jig is up, bud. You know, I'm going to tell Alfred what's going on, and, you know, you're never going to get your position back, and blah, blah, blah. Which, incredibly stupid move to do, because you're provoking this person, and he's already shown that he doesn't have any restraint. And I don't know if we as the audience are supposed to take away from this that his time with the pagan Vikings has loosened his inhibitions even more than they were before towards killing. But he obviously has no inhibitions here.
Yeah, and so this makes me wonder if Alfred is correct to wonder if Hegman has changed, because you have to go, wait, did Cuthred underestimate Hegman when he sent this letter? Could he not imagine what was about to happen? Maybe he used to know Hegman, but Hegman has changed, as Alfred has wondered. And that's why Hegman just felt completely comfortable riding off to go kill him immediately after reading that letter.
It seems, I think you're right. I think that's probably what it is. Because it seems stupid to us, because we know what Hegman's capable of. But here you have Cuthred thinking about the fact that he's a bishop and he's having this quarrel with a man who used to be a bishop. What's your job as a bishop? To uphold God's word on earth. Mm-hmm. One of those 10 rules is thou shalt not kill. So there you go. Why would he do it? Why would he be doing it? But he was obviously wrong. And we have the pretty brutal and nasty scene of Hegman killing Cuthred. And the visuals of this were really cool, but I'm a little bit confused by the end of it. Mm-hmm. The after he kills him, and he kills him on the altar, and then he kind of does the last rites, and then almost like contemptuously throws his hand out there and then throws the knife mm-hmm. right at him and walks out of the church. So
maybe that's his feelings toward the church.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Like, I wanted to get your take on this. Do you think, I guess my question boils down to this. After he does it, you know, obviously, I think I've already figured out for myself anyway why he thought it was okay to kill this guy in the church, because he was thinking that it is much more of a grievous sin to let this hypocrite pretender who mm-hmm. isn't a man of God be in that position than it is to actually commit one of the seven deadly sins, right? Inside of a church mm-hmm. on the altar. Mm-hmm. And then, I think it's one of the seven deadly sins. I guess it would be because it's deadly, right? But so do you think that he is turning away from God and says, hey, I'm just going to go be with Lagertha and you guys can have all this? But
the seven deadly sin, it would be wrath, right? That he was committing and then he broke a commandment by murdering, right?
There you go. Yeah. Okay.
I agree with you, and I've already touched on it a little bit. I think, you know, the hypocrisy you've listed, I just think he doesn't believe him to be a true believer or anybody else who would be of his ilk, of Cuthred's ilk. So maybe he believes it's himself up against the church now as far as who's the most faithful, who's the most
true believer, the truest embodiment of what the church means, at least to Hegman's line of thinking, which obviously would be him.
Someone who, as he described, who would do anything that God decreed from him, pluck out his own eyes.
Yeah. So he's looking at himself as the perfect example. He's almost like an apostle of mm-hmm. Jesus in his own mind, to where he's just like going, I'm going to do whatever needs to be done, whatever God needs me to do. And in his mind, God needs him to do this, or Jesus needs him to do this, because this person is an imposter and this is rot inside of the church. So even if he can't have that position, or perhaps might not want it anymore, he's still going to remove him, and he can do so because of all the reasons he just listed and because he's killing for his king. So he can still have, he's taking out somebody who would try to dethrone Alfred.
It's also something that maybe we should look at in comparison to Floki's history and Floki's questions about his sanity and whether or not he really had this relationship with his gods. I mean, because you could actually apply that all to Hegman here as well. There's no proof of any of it.
Right. All these things deal with faith. He's creating his own reality based on his faith, right? So
on his passion.
Yeah, on his passion, on his angers, his lusts, his everything. You know, it's all coming together. And it's cool that you mentioned Floki, because if you think about it, they're almost inversions of each other, at least in this episode, or on their current trajectories.
I feel like we always try to look for an inversion.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with Floki.
Well, it feels like this one fits, though, because as much as Floki is doubting himself and just overcome with all of this, what if I'm wrong, what if I'm wrong, Hegman has never been more convinced that he's right, it seems to me. Insofar as that he's willing to go and kill the bishop. So there you go. I mean, that's sometimes we do look for those things, and sometimes there's a hard fit. You know, you just kind of try to like saw off the edges. But this one's pretty neatly tailored to the episode. So between that dynamic that we were talking about and like what was going on with Eivind and some of these characters seeming to be a little bit more, or looking like they might get a little bit more complex, and Hegman just got a lot more complex, that to me is the upside of this episode that more than makes up for the stuff with Bjorn and the princess that
Elswith
that, you know, we just don't really care for. So it balanced itself out with some really cool stuff that's good Vikings, and then some, you know, to kind of erase the, or make up for the stuff that we're just not so hot about.
All right, you ready to get into feedback?
Let's do it.
All right. Again, it's just a reminder to everybody, feedback is due on Fridays, Eastern Standard Time at 8 p.m., Central Standard Time at 7 p.m., and you can mail your feedback into noshipnetwork@gmail.com, and our episodes will be available to listen to usually by Saturday afternoons. That's what I aim for. All right, and up first, we have Felix. Felix says, "Hello from Australia. This is my first time writing in as I have just caught up with this wonderful show and your wonderful podcast. Season 5B has already given us so much, especially on the Wessex front, which I've always enjoyed and have thought about. Alfred has to be the most responsible teenage boy ever to be crowned king, already making promises and alliances to heathens. Egbert would be so proud. He seems like a new character this season, as he hasn't mentioned his real father once. I was honestly expecting him to ask either Bjorn or Lagertha about Athelstan at some point. He went all the way to Lindisfarne last season, so why not pester a few Vikings about their old slave? With that, his birth situation hasn't been referenced yet, which is strange since it could easily be used against him towards his legitimacy. The Alfred haters haven't done their homework." That's a great point.
Yeah, it is. I'm wondering if he's not bringing, if they're not writing the character to bring it up to these people, like you said, Felix, to the other Vikings, because they don't want there to be that weird dichotomy of like, well, how come he can talk to them about it, but no one's challenging him about it type of thing.
They're not starting their birther campaign.
See Alfred's birth certificate.
Felix goes on to say, "On the Norse front, I can't believe that Bjorn can just make eye contact with a Saxon princess and be in Bone Town by the end of the episode. Elswith is a respectable Saxon woman living under the constant threat of Viking attack. How could she feel for Bjorn, who was at the head of the great heathen army? How many more women will fall at Bjorn's feet this season? It seems he's constantly got a younger woman to distract him now." Yeah.
We were talking about that. We mentioned that earlier about how it just seems every season it's like, oh, here's another one.
Glare another woman's undies off. Felix says, "But the most important question for this season, when will Fitzer get a personality? His drunken threat to Ivar was good. I want more of that instead of the dog he continues to be." Yeah, I think it was Donuts or Dr. D's, our listener, who called Fitzer plus one. I think she started that last season or the season before, which is still appropriate.
Yeah, it's an apt description for sure.
Thank you, Felix.
Thank you, Felix. All right, up next is another first-time writer, Raven. Raven says, "Longtime listener of The Wild Hunt, first-time writer to the podcast. Here are a couple of thoughts I had while watching the recent episode on Wednesday night. Slaves. Is it me, or do the men of Ragnar's family have bad luck with relationships with slaves? Bjorn's first wife leaves him, who was a slave. Ragnar kills Idu in a drug-needed fugue state, and now Margrethe killed. This makes me fearful for Freydis and her machinations if Ivar ever finds out what she is about with the pregnancy thing. Why did I get an eerie feeling that Freydis reminded me of Idu?" Did you get that? Did you get that feeling?
No, but I think that's a good parallel where you have somebody who is manipulating. She's not using drugs, but she is using a weakness to manipulate Ivar with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and she's doing it great. But you bring up a good point, Raven, about the whole slaves doing this. I hadn't really thought about that. I hadn't, like, my thoughts hadn't gone that way to kind of corral all that in and say, oh, they all had this in common and look what happened. Raven goes on to say, "Fallen queens, why do I have a feeling that Judith, as well as Lagertha, might fall? I do feel that this is Lagertha last season. Sad, I know, but it might be Judith's as well. Judith feels like she has all these great plans going on. Alfred ascending to the crown, his marriage to Elswith, but it will blow up in her face. Æthelred, Bjorn, and Haemon, or all three, will be her undoing, but for now, I don't know. Thoughts?"
I would say, just because of that look that took place when Hegman and Judith saw each other again after so long, I'm going to put my money on Hegman's going to be part of her undoing.
I could see that. I mean, that feels like a good bet.
If there is an undoing.
Yeah, if there is an undoing, because she says, like, fallen queens, why do I have a feeling that Judith as well as Lagertha might fall? Lagertha, I'm taking her out of this particular running because I feel like she's already fallen as far as she's going to go. I'm not saying she's going to live to see the very last episode of this series or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I think she will die at some point. The Seer has even said so, but it's not anytime real soon. And as far as falling, I think she's hit her bottom, and now she's clawing her way back up.
She's going to die on her feet with her boots on.
Yeah, Yeah.
In battle.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, I could see this being Judith's last season too, because I think there's a lot more courtly intrigue to come with when all of these pieces that have just now get. I think we're going to have another episode or so of introducing some new characters. Then they're all going to, the board is set, and then the pieces will start moving.
Well, I think Elswith is going to get caught with Bjorn, and Judith is going to have to find another wife for Alfred, and eventually that wife will be found, and Judith will kind of just go to the wayside.
The discarded character pile right over here. Thank you, Raven.
Yes, thank you, Raven. All right, our final piece of feedback comes from Dr. D's, and she says, "Hey, guys, it's questionable whether this episode deserves such purple prose as a Shakespearean title. If you want to say that A, both of those people were usurpers in a way, and B, they also kind of deserve to die, but C, it doesn't really matter that they died, then okay, I suppose we can loosely compare this episode to Hamlet." Loosely glares.
Very, very loosely.
Dr. D says, "What I loved. One, can't believe I'm saying this, but everything in the Hegman storyline. For the first time, I believe Hegman cares for Lagertha, although I suspect it's because Jonathan Rhys-Meyers finally got to know Catherine Winnick in person. Also, the whole thing with Cuthred was delicious. Two, I don't know why, but Fitzurk and Crazy Margaret were sweet and funny partners, and it works. Number three, Alex Hugh getting the chance to act like more than a rage monster. Four, Torvi giving Bjorn a hard time. Five, Bjorn lurking as flirting."
Lurking as flirting. Usually, you know, people just call the cops, but hey, you know, back then.
Six, Uba as a free agent. He refuses to speak for others, but takes people seriously when they take him seriously. He knows his father well enough to know he'd reconsider his religion. What I didn't like. One, the ham-fisted writing behind Cuthred's spy saying the Othello line, "beast with two backs," after Cuthred just said fornicating. How busted is that to have a one-eyed spy, by the way? Pretty damn busted.
it seems like it was done for visual effect, so he looks like menacing and kind of shady, but you're right. It's like, if you're gonna, I mean, you're the fucking bishop. I mean, you can't afford a better spy. Like, you should have one with big eyes.
Two, Elswith and Bjorn, unless they're saying Judah's family has a Viking kink. Three, Iceland. This storyline is a disaster. I just want to wrap up by saying it's no surprise Ivar killed Margreth, crazy or not. She was the first person to float the idea of his deity simply to save herself, and now he bought into the fiction and can't have anyone who can't be gaslit still living, especially a woman. She was terrible, but her murder was sad because her brush with the Ragnarsons combined with a weak mind destroyed her as a person. Talk to you next week, Dr. D's. Yeah, I like what you said about Margaret there. I know she wasn't great. I agree with you, but I think, you know, you still have some empathy for her, and it's nice to pour one out for Margaret. Just a little.
Just a little bit. Just a few drops of ale for Margaret. I like what you said about Ube too on the pros list, the loved list. As a being a free agent, refusing to speak for others, but takes people seriously when they take him seriously, and he knows his father well enough to know he'd reconsider his religion. So,
but he became cynical about religion overall.
Yeah. Because we wanted to kind of touch on that too, because Alfred had brought it up, in the sense of, was it this episode or last episode? I don't remember, but I think it was last episode. He brought it up about how even at the end, Ragnar wasn't in the favor of the gods.
It
was this episode. You're right. It had to be, duh. But it's not to say that Ragnar became a Christian. I think he just became disillusioned with all of it. And Ube's not there yet, but he's probably the one who's the most open to it. Because, like I said, I don't think it would have worked on Bjorn for a couple of different reasons. And so I'm glad, Donuts, to see that you're on board with us and probably everybody else with the what I didn't likes list, Elswith and Bjorn and Iceland. I just don't see too many fans of either of those things. One of those situations is redeemable. One of them can be made at least interesting, but neither of them right now are like what I look forward to when a new Vikings episode comes up.
Which one's redeemable?
The
Bjorn one? There's nothing.
No. Iceland's redeemable. The Bjorn one can be made to be interesting.
Okay.
if it gets like maybe crazy enough. You know, you can get
nip-tuck crazy.
Exactly. You squeeze some entertainment value out of it by just going like, you know, because Hearst does some wild shit now and then. And it doesn't really have like a place here or there. It just happens. Count Odo and his sadomasochism. Yeah. You just got to make us care about that situation more. That's what we're asking for. And the whole Bjorn and Elswith thing can be made to be interesting by, you know, just really pressing it for that entertainment value and seeing what drips out. It's a really gross, bad way to describe it, but it fits. Thank you, Dr. D's.
Yes, thank you, Dr. D's. Thank you, everyone. We'll be back next week. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. Axe time.
Sword time.
Shields are splintered.